Okay, let's have some fun now. We'll take your phone calls with Kevin Randall right here on Coast to Coast AM, so get ready. Kevin, I got to tell you about a case a couple of years ago. I had a speech in a hotel, and I don't know. Do you know Ed Grimsley by any chance?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, he has night vision goggles, and he's got his own theory about what he's seeing up there. He thinks there's a Star Wars-type war going on. But anyway, he took a group of us to the top of the roof of a hotel. We're looking with these night vision goggles in the third generation. And I got to tell you, Kevin, what I saw, clearly there were objects up there. I don't know what they were, but these things were making 90-degree turns, stops. And, I mean, they were way, way up there, but I saw two of them doing that. You know, you know it's not a satellite because they just go from one end to the other. These things were making jagged turns, stopping, starting. What the heck could they be?
I have no clue.
No.
I know when we were in Iraq with our, I never thought to look at the sky with my night vision goggles.
You would have seen something, maybe.
I probably should have done that.
There's something going on out there. I mean, clearly they weren't planes. You know, I thought maybe they were insects, but, you know, they were just making these 90-degree jagged turns were just too precise to be a bug. I don't know what they were. I really don't. It was fascinating. It really was. What do you think of the Phoenix Lights case? Have you checked into that one?
I've done some work on it. I was out in Phoenix to do a talk. Sometime around that time.
97, I think.
Yeah, I got to meet a number of the people who were involved in that. And clearly there were some flares being dropped, and clearly there were some misidentifications of aircraft, and clearly there was something else going on. I think it's Jim Kelly told me about a couple of police officers in a helicopter that had seen the lights and had chased them. There was clearly some kind of a triangular-shaped object that moved from, I think, the Tucson up toward the Phoenix area and beyond that.
And huge.
Yeah, so there was something going on. There was other things going on besides just the misidentification of some lights and things like that. But there was some fascinating stuff going on.
All right, let's go to the phones. They're lining up for you. Glenn is in Harlingen, Texas. Welcome to the show. Hey, Glenn.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
I really appreciate your work. Made colonel, huh? That's good news.
Well, lieutenant
he's
colonel.
One of the best.
appreciate you as well, George.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask you, Mr. Randall, if you think there's a possibility that the Internet may have something to do with the reduced frequency of sightings vis-a-vis they wouldn't be completely befuddled by cruising along and all of a sudden picking up a rerun of I Love Lucy, but could plug into every library in the world. And one more question for either of y'all. There was a great Outer Limits episode about how a group of scientists genetically and surgically altered a volunteer and built a one-of-a-kind hypersonic aircraft that they were going to have a false flag event. But they did such a good job he crashed, and they did such a good job that he was hunted as a real alien, I believe. But I can't remember that episode's name, but I can see the actors. If either one of y'all can remember that, I'd really appreciate it.
I remember the episode, and but I don't know what the name of it is. If it had been a Twilight Zone episode, I've got a reference book I could look it up.
Yeah, we would have had that one.
But I remember the Outer Limits episode, and I couldn't tell you the name of it, but I do remember that.
Oh, that's unfortunate. That was great. I'll have to research and find out.
Should be easy for you there, Glenn. Those programs, though, were great, Kevin. Weren't they for science fiction?
Absolutely. And they still show up periodically on some of the cable networks once in a while. So, you have to be careful you don't see the ones that were done in the, what is it, the 1990s. You
right.
You want to see the old black and white ones. Addressing the internet, it's interesting, and because as I was working on Confessions of a Ufologist, and I was looking at the tale told by Carol Wayne Watts, and he was saying that as he moved through the craft, he came to this desk where they had all these maps stacked up, and I'm thinking, gee, didn't they have Google Earth? But the point being, if you had the technology to travel interstellar distances, or in this case, interplanetary distances, you would have had the capability of mapping the Earth a lot better than using paper maps and things like that. He might be right. I mean, you could tap into the internet and pick up everything that you wanted to know. And I did a piece about how my cell phone is better than a Star Trek communicator, because the communicator just allowed you to talk to the ship and things like that. But my cell phone gives me all the knowledge of the human race. Just ask the right question, and I get all the knowledge of the human race on my cell phone. Not to mention games and everything else. So that, you know, it's an interesting idea that the internet, they may be circulating in space and just using Wi-Fi to pick up what they want to know now.
Next up, we go to Kingston, New York. Henry's with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Henry. Thanks for calling.
Hi, George. Last night when you had your guest on, he was talking about the Pope and...
Yeah,
and
Brother Diamond.
...how they were demon-related. And it reminded me of a sighting I experienced when I was a child. I was driving in a car with my parents, and we had seen up in front of us, we were on a parkway near New York City, and we had seen a few people had stopped, pulled off the side of the road, and were standing outside their cars looking up. And so we slowed down for maybe about 20, 25 seconds, and I watched this very classic elliptical shape, which had a fiery plasma glow on it with a small little vapor trail trailing off the back end. And this was no small dot or anything. I could literally see the streaming plasma on its shell. And I watched it make an elliptical turn. And this would have been over the Hudson River, okay? And we tried to see if anybody else reported. The next day, there were no reportings whatsoever. And oddly enough, some years later, we actually moved to that same area alongside the parkway. And then some years later after that, it coincidentally turned out that the Pope actually came to that very same spot and partied, because there's a seminary located there. And when he was visiting, they came there and threw a big celebration, and Kelly Clarkson sang and everything. I just thought it was kind of coincidence, because your guest last night, too, was mentioning how some people can see these and some people don't. And I was thinking maybe this is like some kind of hot spot. You know, but the other odd thing about it was... a year or so ago, I was reading about some sightings in the Wanakee Reservoir area of New Jersey in the late 60s. And so what I do is I took a map and I drew a line from where we spotted it to where I observed it, and extended the line out and went right to that reservoir in New Jersey. And so I thought it was kind of unusual, because this is not like some little dot or a spot or a light. This was actually a large enough craft. And like I said, we weren't the only people who noticed them. I mean, because people we had seen pull off the highway. And before I hang up, I wanted to ask you, I sent you an email twice with a little movie link in it. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
I do not, no.
Oh. Well, a while back, I
sometimes had sometimes these emails go straight to spam. And a lot of times, if you can just resend it under some kind of different heading, it'll get through.
Okay, because on one of my previous calls, I mentioned to you that every time I tried to bring up a certain technology, it seems to get shut down, that I had trouble getting it across the George Knapp. And
that's interesting.
On your show. And so I made you, and you said, well, send me an email about it, which I did. I don't know if you ever read it. So I made you a little movie, which I figured you could, it's like a 6-minute movie, and it explains it all.
Okay, I'd love to say I saw it, but I haven't.
Well, I could try sending it again if you...
Can you send it from a different email account? Because yours is probably going into spam.
Sure. I think I send it from two different ones, but I can.
Try it again.
Should I title it anything special? Or
you just say, I talked to you on the show.
Okay.
So I'll know. I'll know indeed. Kevin, what do you think of the case of Philip Corso? Do you think he was legit? Do you think he was, you know, I mean, he was who he said he was, but I mean, what do you think of his story?
As it relates to Roswell, I just don't think it fits in. And knowing what I do about the way you move classified materials from one location to another, his story of seeing the body at Fort Riley, Kansas, which, by the way, is where we went before we trained at Fort Riley before we went to Iraq, as a coincidence. I just don't see how the security on something like that would be so lax that he and his sergeant friend could have had seen it. That's a real stumbling block for me. So that kind of turned me off. Yeah, clearly he was a lieutenant colonel. Clearly he'd serve for
Eisenhower and mm-hmm. the rest. And
yeah, clearly he did.
I mean, he was who he was.
Yes,
no doubt about that.
Absolutely. That puzzles me too. Clearly he was a battalion commander out at White Sands. Clearly he was in Europe as an intelligence officer. Clearly he was at the Pentagon as an intelligence officer. But the story of him seeing the body at Fort Riley just doesn't make any sense to me. It's really not on the route to go from Roswell to Wright-Patterson, and I don't think they would be taking the things in trucks. They would have been using aircraft because they had the capability to use aircraft. So it just, that really bothers me.
Good point. Let's go to Greenville, South Carolina. Alexander, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hey there, go ahead.
Yeah, I had a contact with a UFO in August 27th, 1952, and I reported it to Mitchell Field. And the report was...
Mitchell Field where?
Mitchell Field, New York.
Okay, because there's a Mitchell Field in Milwaukee as well.
Yeah, well, actually, there was a landing at Mitchell Field in 1957. Two officers had seen a UFO park between two hangars in the field. And when they were returning from the coffee break, they saw the thing was gone. But here's my report. The UFO that I had seen came down in a swamp, and it was 30 feet in diameter. It had an egg-shaped dome in the center. It was spinning, and it had red and blue landing lights. It had a crew of three little men, about 3 feet tall, large head, small body, very small mouth, and a very small nose, and very large eyes. Plus, they had green uniforms on, blue caps. They had an insignia on the side of the craft, which was a half moon with a V, like an arrow, standing. And then underneath the arrow, there was one little line. The same insignia appeared in Lonnie Zamora in 1957. I had my contact on the 27th of August, 1952. Plus, the man in Florida saved my life. He was burned in the Everglades on the 19th of August, 1952. And the following week was the 27th. I had my encounter. And 2 weeks after that, in West Virginia, at Point Pleasant, West Virginia, Mothman appeared. I have a feeling the reason Mothman appeared was because of me. I was 6'9" when I had my contact. But actually, the craft changed in colors. The egg itself changed in colors. It made bluish white, bluish green, reddish orange, and brightish white amber. And when it was in its reddish orange, you could see on the side of the craft, you could see the insignia, which was underneath the disc. It was like a submarine where a conning tower rose and lowered.
Do you get reports of insignias, Kevin, much?
There are lots of reports of insignia, and I know Bud Hopkins, for example, has been collecting samples of symbology seen inside the craft. So there are reports of people seeing insignia on the craft, and as he pointed out, what he described is the classic symbol from the Lonnie Zamora sighting from 1964. So you know, there's lots of those sorts of reports, and people look at that and see if they can figure out some kind of a pattern.
In your opinion, what do you think's going on, Kevin, with all this? These cases, these apparent landings, what's going on?
I think there's no doubt there's alien visitation. And the question then becomes, is it a single entity, I mean, single source, single race, or is it multiple races? How many are there, and how far away are they? You know, what could we learn from them that we don't know now? Clearly, to me, it's extraterrestrial in origin. There are, I suppose, you could say it may be interdimensional. It might be time travelers. I believe the most likely explanation is extraterrestrial, meaning from another planet. Less likely is interdimensional. Even less likely than that would be time travelers.
What about demons?
Pardon me?
What about demons? Some people believe they're demons.
I don't really see any evidence that suggests that at all. I know that there are people who say it's demons in some fashion, but I just don't think so. Unless you're thinking of demons as some kind of an interdimensional creature, which I suppose you could, and then
maybe, yeah,
you could look at it that way. But I think the most likely explanation is alien.
Well, I have long suspected that that's a very strong possibility, Kevin. Very strong indeed. Next up, we have Ray in Citrus Springs, Florida. Go ahead, Ray.
Hey, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to tell the Lieutenant Colonel back in 82, I'm here down in Florida in a subdivision, and they had a lot of roads that they made, but there wasn't no houses. So one night, me and my wife, we took a drive, and we were going around. We parked the car, and it was nice, you know, no lights or nothing. And I looked over toward the west, and I seen zigzags. I said, what the heck is that? And we got out of the car, and we're watching. And George, swear to God, this craft come over, maybe up 100 feet, maybe 50, 60 foot, all silver with a dome. Didn't make no noise, but underneath it had, like, ports. Just like when you turn on a butane lighter, go shh,
mm-hmm.
And one would go off, and then on the other side would go off. And my wife said, nobody's going to believe us. And I told my mom. My mom believed me, but my dad didn't. But that was back in 82.
and it's too bad it was 82, because you wouldn't have had a cell phone to take a picture.
That's the thing. I mean, now we've got all this technology, and that's why we get what we get. Kevin, I want to get your take on the Billy Meyer case as well when we come back after the break. Give me a quick synopsis. What do you think of that case?
Not much.
Do you think he's a great photographer?
I just lump him in. I lump him in with the contactees from the 1950s. George Van Tassel.
Adamski.
Adamski, certainly. Williamson. Those guys, he's just one of those guys. I don't think there's really anything extraterrestrial involved with his sightings.
Stay with us. Kevin Randall, our special guest tonight. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Kevin's website, of course, kevinrandall.blogspot.com. It's linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And when we come back in just a moment, we'll take final phone calls. And those of you on hold, don't leave or you'll lose your place in line. We'll be right back. Well, if you're in the greater St. Louis area, Washington, Missouri, Potosi, Sullivan, Missouri, and all the stations that pick us up in the Midwest there in the Missouri area, and you felt a little rumble tonight just a few minutes ago, you did. You just got hit by a 4.2 magnitude earthquake. No reports yet on damage. That's pretty good size, let me tell you, for the Midwest. And, of course, that's right around the New Madrid Fault. Our thanks, by the way, to Sean Streeter, the news anchor at our affiliate in St. Louis, KTRS, for getting us that quick information that an earthquake has hit in that greater St. Louis area. It's 51 miles in St. Louis from the epicenter and 14 miles from Sullivan, Missouri. So the Midwest continues to get battered away. Geez, I'm going to be there on Friday. 4.2. Let's hope that's it. We'll be back with more with Kevin Randall on Coast to Coast AM. Ever been in an earthquake, Kevin?
Yes, I have.
They're not fun, are they?
It woke me up. It wasn't a bad one.
I think a 4.2 would probably wake you up. My three kids probably got woken up. I'm going to call them after the show here, see how they're doing. Anyway, let's get back to some final calls here for you. We'll go to Mary, first of all, the state of Washington, west of the Rockies. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi there. I was in Suquamish, Washington, shortly after Earth Day for a cleanup in the village. And there was a fair and, you know, barbecue, and some people were making arrowheads and teaching the children how to make arrowheads. It's on the Port Madison Tribal Reservation. And it was a wonderful and festive day, and there were quite a lot of people, I'd say maybe 200 people. And I happened to look up, and there I wondered if you had heard tell or knew of what these massive black triangle things are. I looked up and I saw something I would never expect to see in all my born days. And I'm not a UFO fan, or it probably is the subject of least interest in my entire life. And I looked up and there are, you know, perhaps four Empire State Buildings tall, maybe six, from horizon to horizon, absolutely silent in the sky above me. And it was moving, just the tiniest bit. And I stood there and looked and looked and looked. And my first thought was, Lord Almighty, Whidbey is really doing its work. That's really something we've done. And it was silent. And it, you know, up into in the sky, there is nothing to gauge its size. But its mass was stupendous.
How big are these things, Kevin?
Well, most of the triangular sighting, and that was, as she was talking, I was thinking that you know, the evolution of UFOs goes from the disks to the triangles around 1989, 1990, we began to get a lot of reports of triangular-shaped objects as opposed to saucer-shaped. But most of them aren't that massive. They're somewhat smaller than what she's described there. But that's what we're getting more and more reports of, are the triangular-shaped objects.
Do you believe that we could be visited by this huge mothership, and then the smaller ones come out of that and come down?
It seems to me that some of the smaller ones just would not be interstellar ships. The distances are too vast, and they seem to be too small, unless, of course, they've got a really good way of defeating the distances.
Like knowing how to get through that wormhole.
Yeah, then that you know, all bets are off at that point. But it makes sense to me. I mean, we have aircraft carriers, and you know, when the skeptics talk about, well, there's so many different kinds of UFOs that we see. You know, could we settle on one kind? I think, well, you know, if an aircraft carrier, you know, launches all its aircraft, you're going to get lots of different shapes and sizes and configurations. So it that makes perfect sense to me that there's some kind of mothership that they come from that's orbiting around the Earth. And I know that Kehoe and some of the people in the 50s, late 50s, early 60s talked about something like that.
I wonder if governments have seen them in space. And, you know, we know what we've heard from, you know, about astronauts. But I wonder if they've got photographs, if there's some file somewhere with these incredible pictures.
It's probably the moon dust file.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there are. I'm sure that if we knew where to look and we knew how to access the information, that we could find some very, very spectacular stuff. I did talk to a fellow who told me that he had been an officer, and one of his duties had been to review the Roswell material first at the base there in Roswell to make sure that there was nothing left classified that they should have there, and then other locations to destroy some of that material that was out of date, and to make sure that it was properly hidden or properly classified, I should say.
And you've talked to enough people in your career, Kevin. You know when they're lying or not. You can tell, can't you?
I would have, you know, if you'd asked me that question 10 years ago, I'd have said, yeah, I can pretty well tell, but I've been fooled by some people, so.
Really?
Frank Kaufman fooled me.
Oh, Frank, I interviewed him, too.
And Frank turned out to be bogus. I mean,
God, he was a great interview, though.
Oh, and he bought me so many breakfasts in Roswell. You know, I'd go to Roswell and we'd go to breakfast, and he would spin tales. But after he'd passed away, I know Mark Rodiker and Mark Chesney and Don Schmidt had an opportunity to visit with his widow, and in his house they found the typewriters, they found the documentation that showed that he wasn't telling us the truth.
Why would he make that up? He didn't profit from it, did he?
Well, I know that one interview that he made at least $1,000 off of. The Japanese came to interview him.
Ah, they paid him.
Oh, they paid lots of people. The Japanese were throwing money around like there was no tomorrow. But the draw of the spotlight is very powerful. So you not look at the compensation just monetarily, but also the attention it draws to you and that sort of thing. And Frank was, if you'd been to his house and seen the paintings, his paintings, the man was fabulously talented as a painter. I mean, the paintings were, to my uneducated eye, were just fantastic.
Well, that explains his incredible story to me because, you know, he talked about how, you know, he was in part of this military unit and he came upon this crashed saucer stuck into the, into the ground. But it was like he was painting a picture when he was telling me.
Well, the problem is I have to take full responsibility for Frank Kaufman because I was the one that talked to him first.
Yeah, Stan told me that. You found him first.
Yeah, and well, then we can point to Stan and say, yeah, but you got Gerald Anderson. So we're even, pal.
But you know what? He could have been a credible witness. And had he ended up being one, you would have been a hero in that one.
Absolutely, but Frank fooled me. I know that there are visual cues that when people are lying, and I look for that, you know, their body language
twitching something, yeah.
And at least the one that I always remembered is, you know, if you're talking to someone and they touch their nose, that means they don't believe what they're saying or what you're saying. But the thing is, you have to remember it may be that the nose itch too.
That's right.
But I know when they talk to news, put people on the air, the talking heads on newscasters and things like that, they tell them, don't touch your face when you're on the air because it's a visual cue that you may not be telling the truth. So people can fool you. And I know there are people who pretend to be Vietnam veterans, for example. And it's very difficult to tell the guys who are making it up from the guys who are actually there. Sometimes it's very difficult. They've got their line of patter down so well.
Yeah, I tell people I was in the Navy 9 years, of course, and never saw not in active service in terms of warfare, nothing like that. I was a public information officer. I mean, that was it. Nothing dramatic at all. But, you know, people think when you're in the military, you're in the heat of battle all the time. I wasn't.
Well, yeah, and I spent a year in Vietnam, and we'd sometimes go weeks, and nobody would shoot at the flight, and then it seemed like it was a daily occurrence. It just depended on what was going on and where you are and what the mission was and all kinds of things. So
yeah.
it just really depended.
Let's go to Oakley, California. Paul, you're up with us. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Kevin, hi.
Happy birthday to you, too, Kevin.
Thank you.
We were born on the same day.
Oh, wow, what a coincidence. I have an observation. My background is I'm a computer engineer for about 15 years. At the age of about 17, I started flight school locally, and I've been on aircraft all my life. And me too in the military, been in helicopters. So I know about aircraft, and I can see. And I'm also a private investigator. I'm not to give out, also an author. But about 2 months ago, I was on my break, and I was eating my lunch, talking on the phone with my wife, and I saw a metallic object. It looked like what they call a bell. It was silver, and I figured it about 10 miles away. Now, within about maybe 7 seconds of me observing this object, I knew where it came from, I knew where it was heading, and I knew it was no balloon. because of the trajectory it was going, and it was coming. It was coming from a very sensitive area, and it was not an aircraft. And it was very low, and it disappeared. It kind of like phased out, and then came back. Now, within that small time frame, it was about dusk. So it had been something that it pulled it out, if it was a UFO, pulled it out of its cloaking, came out for about 5 seconds, and then went back into cloaking. I went around to see if it was going to come out, and it was on the other side like a mound, and then see if it would come out on the other side, and I did not see it come out because of the distance. And it was flying from west to east in California. Now, here's the catcher. Where it was coming from was a very sensitive area called Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. It was on the trajectory. It was on the Healy side, flying very low. Now, from what I know of, very low above radar, below radar. And second, it was going towards a, what they call a GE. General Electric has like a semi-nuclear plant out there. It's been known for years. Actually, it had an accident way back in the 70s. It released radiation, killed cattle in that area. And it was heading that way. And I checked the maps and kind of figured it where it was coming from and where it was going. So within maybe 7 seconds, I saw it. And what was really weird is it disappeared. No aircraft would disappear within about a second and come back. The only thing I can think of is because of the way the sun was hitting it and the way it was flying, it disappeared and came back. It was probably having problems because I saw it for about 5 seconds. Well, I'd say about 3 to 5 seconds. And then it went out, and then it came back. It had problems, but I knew it was coming from a sensitive area going into another sensitive area.
And what do you think it was, Paul? What's your gut tell you?
It was no balloon, because I know those hills. In other words, the air goes from west to east. All that, it's kind of like the Bay Area. So I know the storms come west to east. Even the area of the hills or the storms. So I know it was no balloon. And when I saw that, right away I knew something was not right within about 10 miles. And ever since then, I started going around doing some internet looking around, see if anybody's been looking at weird things in the area. And sure enough, all around there, all the way up to Fremont. Fremont, now what's in Fremont, you might say? What's in that area? NASA's in that area. FAA is in that area. All that area has been having weird kind of aircraft. But this was kind of different because it was in an isolated area. It was kind of like if you look over Google and look down, there's like a lake. I tell friends and says, "Well, why don't you go out there?" I said, "If I go out there, I'll probably find something, something that I know I will find." And my gut feeling is, based on what I see in my background, based on what my investigation is, this thing was lying low, trying to get out of the way, trying not to be seen, and it was flying within low radar, coming out of some type of a cloaking and getting into a cloaking again. Now I know for a fact its trajectory was heading towards probably that plant. It's kind of like a General Electric. It's still there. And I'm not sure whether it's fully operational, but they do have radiation sensors all over. So my gut feeling is just that it was definitely some type of a unknown aircraft that can cloak out and cloak back in. And
I just hit your button. Hold on, Paul. There you go. Still there? Paul, you there?
I'm here.
Yeah, there you are.
Yeah, I'm right here. So that's my gut feeling.
Okay, so you got it. Okay. All right, good. I bopped you right at the wrong time, but you were done anyway. Kevin, do you get many stories about this cloaking?
You take a look at some of the stories that have been told over the years, and it makes sense that they have some way of hiding. There were a series of pictures taken over Fort Belvoir in the 1960s of a ring-shaped UFO. And you see it move across the sky, and eventually it is encompassed in a cloud. It looks like the rest of the clouds in the sky. So that would be a form of cloaking as well. But the way they fade out, it's either they accelerate extremely fast, and so fast you can't follow them. Which I suppose if you're an alien race, you might have the capability of doing that. Or they have some kind of device that can cause them to kind of fade out and not be seen that easily.
All right. Next up, we go to Joanne in Corrales, New Mexico. Hey, Joanne, let's get you in here real fast.
Okay. Nice to talk with you. I'm wondering if the aliens, are you there?
Yeah.
The aliens that they got in Roswell, did they have a blood type?
Did they ever check them for that?
I'm sure they did. And I'm sure as our technology develops, we look for DNA and all of that sort of thing as well. But we have no good information about that. I mean, we haven't been able to find that information, but I'm sure that they would have checked for all of that sort of stuff to see how it compared to humans.
All right, Kevin, we've only got about a minute and a half or so to go, and I want you to get your information out. It's been a while since we had you on to talk about what you've been doing. When does this new book come out that Anomalous Books is going to publish?
It's probably 6 months away. I've just finished up everything for it to get them to the good people at Anomalous Books. So it's probably a long way out, but we've got the crash when UFOs fall from the sky that's been out for about a year. And I think that's got some really good information in it. And there's if you look at Amazon.com under my name, you can find a bunch of other books that are available on UFOs.
All right, Kevin, you are one of the best, my friend, one of the great researchers of all time. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. Keep it up. Don't give up.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your kind words.
All right, keep pushing. That's Kevin Randall, Lieutenant Colonel, retired from the Army. Served in Iraq, by the way, in Vietnam as well. His works, Crash, Operation Roswell, the Exploration Series, and his blog linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. I don't know what's going on in those skies, but something's going on, and a lot of great, credible witnesses are seeing this time and time again. We've got a great week of shows for you in store on Coast to Coast. On our next program, Steve Volk joins me, as he's going to be talking about deathbed visitations on Coast to Coast AM. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.